Hello, hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of the Daily Fringe Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by the venerable Mr. Terence Corrigan. Terence, welcome back to the show. Good to have you on.
Hi, Nicholas.
And we're also joined today by Mr. Marius Ruart. Marius, how are you?
How's it, guys?
Good.
I've had to decamp because Eskom decided that I couldn't have electricity for the afternoon. So I'm in a...
I'm having a red now where I'm actually enjoying some electricity before during the show, which is not usual for me the past few days. Mm-hmm. Anyway, let's not get too caught up on that. Instead, let's talk about something a little bit more interesting, which is that we finally have had the launch of a long-anticipated political party in South Africa, and this is Songezo Zibi's political party, or I'm sure he wouldn't want it characterized that way, but it's the way that I know about it. Rise Mzansi, which has officially had its launch today. And the party is very deliberately identifying itself as what it calls a sort of in the social democratic tradition. They say they reject both the neoliberal capitalism as well as hardline Marxism. They talked in an announcement about how political representatives are, in their words, distant and capable and don't represent the people. That government is populated by the corrupt and uncaring political elite. There's a lot of talk about inequality. They mentioned quite a few times about how they believe they need to uplift marginalized South Africans. They mentioned many times, particularly black women. They go on to say the 1994 solution in South Africa was about securing peace and enshrining political and human rights in our laws. We put structures in place to maintain the peace and sustain the vote and basic democracy. Now is the time to build a nation founded on justice and freedom. That is why we say 2024 is our 1994. The party is called Rise Mzansi. So, Terence, let's start with you. You watched a bit of the launch. What's your take on it? What's your take on what policies you've seen from them so far, such as it is? And do you think they, firstly, A, have good ideas, and B, regardless of whether they have good ideas or not, whether they're going to make a political splash?
Well, look, I think that the issues that they're talking about are all current issues. I think that it's addressing things that are really within the mainstream. There's kind of a mix of what you could call popular concerns and elite concerns. So you have, you know, a lot of talk about about poverty and inequality and opportunities for children, that sort of thing, and then also stuff about climate change, which might, you know, might have a greater purchase with your sort of Daily Maverick, Mail, and Guardian set. I must say there was nothing there that I found objectionable. I did find it interesting the way they took a swing at the ANC and then by sort of implication both the DA and the EFF. Now the DA they kind of talked about in terms of having, well, didn't name it, but it's clear this is what they were referring to. It has reached a ceiling and that sort of thing, which is, I think, sort of fairly mainstream, mainstream conventional wisdom. And I think that in a way they came out on the EFF in a way that in certain quarters would be quite brave to say, you know, this populist threat of violence, stigmatizing particular communities, that your life would be better off without without this community or that community. Once again, didn't name it, but it's very clear that this is what they were referring to. I did find that actually quite refreshing. Position oneself, while decrying racism, but not, you know, excluding anyone or, you know, denouncing anyone as being sort of inherently guilty, or I found quite refreshing. The overall impression really was that it's a click left of center, but nothing that was particularly frightening. I think overall quite pro business and pro free market. Yeah, it seemed to be the, you know, that, as you say, a social democratic trade-off that, you know, we need to get businesses working to provide a safety net. I don't have any great normative problems with that. I think that they're practicalities you maybe have to talk about. Sense though was I'm not sure exactly what would distinguish them in the mind of an uncommitted voter from Action SA or from Musi Maimani's group. I can't remember that. Build One SA. You know, I think what you have here is you know, very clever, very articulate people. You know, sort of passionate about the country. I think they may, the launch certainly seemed to be trying to play on the idea that they're inclusive. It's interesting, you know, this sort of rainbow nation of people on the stage, and they got, you know, let's say a representative from each of the groups to come and speak. And I imagine that, but you know, does this is this the sort of thing that's going to get traction? I could see a lot of Musi Maimani's talking points and what they were saying, you know, and things we've heard before. You know, we're working with communities. We're a different way of doing politics. I imagine that they will probably be quite strong in the ideas front. You may not agree with all their ideas, but I do think that this is the kind of organization that will produce them. And I imagine that if they do secure some sort of notable representation, you are casting around for alliance partners. My sense is that they would probably tend towards the DA. The issue with the DA is, you know, seems to be, well, they've reached the ceiling. Probably they'd probably also tell you, well, you know, insensitive to past injustices, or, you know, broad, you know, tone or whatever. But, you know, when you rank that alongside, you know, complete corrupt criminals, you know, I think that the, you know, the weight of whatever residual sympathy you have seems to tend one direction rather than another. So interesting development. Whether it means anything remains to be seen.
Yeah, I think, you know, with political parties, it can take a little while actually to get the sort of sense of what they're really about, because, you know, the launch is always a very carefully crafted thing. Whenever a political party launches an initiative or themselves, they're always trying to project a very specific image, but quickly through the types of issues they comment on, through some of the sides they pick in whatever the fight of the day is, you kind of, I think, will get a better idea of who they are. Because it's unfortunately true that an awful lot of political organizations, probably all of them to some degree, don't really take some of their own policy and constitutional documents as seriously as they should. And it can sometimes give you a misleading impression if you just read the policy stuff. But anyway, so Marius, you know, in South Africa, the ANC has always done this kind of clever thing of being a pretty far left kind of Marxist-leaning organization, but one that dresses up in the clothes of social democracy. And at least some ANC policies, you could say, are sort of more social democrat than they are straightforward sort of Marxist-Leninist. That being said, because the ANC isn't a social democratic party, because it is this Marxist party, there's been this constant idea in South African politics, let's just make a social democratic party that people can actually vote for, that isn't crazy, that isn't super corrupt. And it's kind of been tried quite a few times before. The UDM was some version of that, for example. The ID, I think, was some version of that for a time. What do you make of this? I mean, it's not 100% clear to me how this party is really going to differentiate itself from that big, solid pack of sort of center-left small parties that have just never really gone anywhere. What do you make of this?
Well, just on the ANC, I think the ANC is... especially the ANC of, say, the 2000s, even the 1990s, was probably a bit more right-wing economically than the DA, for example. It's often spoken about Thabo Mbeki and Trevor Manuel talk left and walk right. And I think that's what they did to a large degree. They were actually fairly business-friendly apart from certain things. And, you know, they were pretty measured in the issues of finances of the country and so on. But yeah, but moving on from that with Razem Zansi, yeah, they don't seem all that objectionable. But they seem to be pretty much what they're saying is we need fewer bad things and more good things. And I was just looking at their economic policy. I mean, they say economic justice and growth must be premised on enabling people to expand their capacity to participate, benefit from new opportunities in the modern economy. The future of work requires an imaginative and expanded approach to employment. An inclusive and growing economy is critical for fighting social ills, crime, and violence. Yes, I think we can all agree on that. How do we get that? How are we going to start growing the economy? You know, are we going to focus on getting manufacturing going again? Or are we going to rather focus on being a services economy? Are we going to be more mixed? What are we going to do about mining? Things such as renewable energy and all that kind of thing. What is the nitty-gritty?
Exactly. And there's a couple of important questions. You know, do we have race as an important part of our determining who gets help and preference? Do we privatize organizations? Stuff like that. Those are much more specific questions, and it feels a little bit like they might be kind of trying to float in between those right now.
Exactly. I think, you know, that's the thing. It's very easy to not really say anything, and nobody can really pin you down. But if it's easy to say, yes, you know, South Africa belongs to everybody who lives in it. That's fine. But are we going to have things like BE? Because if they say we must have no race-based policy, then you're going to get people saying, oh, you don't want to make up for the past, and vice versa. If we say we are going to have a race-based policy, then why? And then people, you know, criticize them. Why do you want to carry on with these policies that haven't worked? So it's much easier to not really say anything, be kind of amorphous, just say nice things and not really get anywhere. But I mean, I'll just say two last things on it. The people who I've heard of that are advisor, you know, prominent, Songezo Zibi, Magashule Ghana, Nick Benadel, and Ishmael Makabela, are all pretty solid guys. I mean, us at the Institute know Ishmael Makabela pretty well. He's on our council, and I think we'll all agree he's a very solid guy, very intelligent man. So I think it's I think that's quite a coup for them to have him on, working with Razem Zansi. And just one thing, it also seems that South Africans can't escape the ANC bubble, but also they can't actually escape the kind of opposition party bubble. So, you know, we've seen these kind of saviors come along before, people like Mampela, even Bantu Olomisa. We haven't really done much. At least Olomisa got into parliament and stayed there, like Hung and Mampela. But perhaps we're going to start seeing in Africa that these, more of the rest of the developing world, these kind of insurgent parties and political movements that we've started seeing in Europe especially, where, you know, people aren't voting for the old, you know, centre-left and centre-right guys anymore. There are these new parties that are coming through. We just saw it now in Holland, where the Boerenburgerbeweging, the citizen farmers movement, was the single largest party in that country's provincial elections now. And the party is only 4 years old and got about 20% of the votes in the elections there now. And because they were, you know, they were going kind of against the, I don't want to call it the mainstream, but against the sort of government narrative and so on. And perhaps we'll start seeing that in Africa. I know in Namibia's last presidential election, an independent got 30% of the vote, and Haji Hangob, he won the election with just under 60% of the vote. But in the last Namibian election for president, he'd won nearly 90% of the vote. So we might start seeing this kind of thing, and maybe South Africa's G4, kind of an insurgent party, that could still kind of maybe be actually saying Hume Mashaba, or maybe it could be Razem Zansi and Songezo Zibi. So, yeah, I think we're in for interesting times. But, I mean, if I was a betting man, I don't think Songezo Zibi is going to be the next president of South Africa. And I think they'll actually have their work cut out to even get more than a handful of seats in parliament.
So I think, and Terence, tell me if I'm wrong here, that, you know, considering how crowded that sort of center-left positioning of our political spectrum is, that if Razem Zansi wants to make a splash, wants to actually break out of the pack a little bit, they're going to really have to protect the credibility of their people very strongly. Because I think what often happens is a party starts and it maybe has one or two charismatic figures in it who people think are quite respectable, but then very quickly the organization gets filled with a sort of, you know, grifters and people who are trying their luck. And, you know, you have what happened, like, for example, to COPE, where it just kind of got taken over by infighting and nonsense and that kind of thing. Do you think that that protecting their credibility is a very big part of them being successful? What do you make of this?
I don't, you know, I think that they stand in a kind of a different lane, the non-political party, which is something we've also had a few attempts at. I do rather get the sense there's something a little bit different about them. Maybe it's because Songezo Zibi is a serious thinker. You know, he's been a businessman, editor. You know, as I say, I think there's a lot of ideas there. But, you know, even if there aren't a lot of ideas on paper now, I think that this is the kind of formation that could produce them. You know, whatever one may think about Mount Magashule, gone a positive or negative as a politician, I will say this: he gave up a seat to go and sort of pursue this, which is, you know, no small thing for a guy who's essentially done politics as a profession. Apparently, he had a very good reputation as a worker. I also. Sort of looking at that stage, what struck me was I don't know, maybe someone contradict me, but I didn't see a great many recycled politicians, you know, along the sort of Action SA route. You know, maybe their downfall is that they are you know, too many thinkers and dreamers rather than organizers, but. I think, you know, one hope I do have for this formation is that it's not gonna succumb to the politics of the Twitterverse. I remember the purple cows. The joke was, well, if Twitter was the election, they'd have swept the board. These guys like writing moo and whatever at the end of their posts, and what they didn't make a single seat. I don't know. I don't see anybody there who is obviously compromised. I don't see people there who look like they've got massive skeletons in their closets. So, you know, perhaps, at least on paper, this is a kind of landscape you can believe in.
You know, no, I think it's going to be very interesting to watch how they perform. And I honestly don't know yet. I think you've raised some good points, Terence, about why they might succeed. But we'll have to see, because it is not an easy thing to start a political party, as all of the many people who have started political parties in recent months can tell you. So I look forward to either polling or maybe some kind of by-election they might stand in. Well, it doesn't seem like they put much of an emphasis on local government as of yet. So,
in their speech, I must say they did emphasize that we've got to get our municipalities working, so you can have whatever money,
right?
Monetary policy framework, whatever. If your actual local government isn't working, they stressed, you know, this idea that you can take a mayor from one town, and you know he can shift to somewhere else. I wonder who they could be talking about.
All right, let's move on to our next topic for today, and this is something that happened this week which we are not too pleased about, and that is the president signed into law the Electoral Amendment Bill. This bill will, at least in theory, it's supposed to rejig our electoral system to comply with a constitutional court ruling which found that you needed to have a space for people to run as independents, not affiliated with any political party, in our political system. However, there are a number of significant problems with these that I'll ask Marius about in a second. But basically, the sort of nutshell of it is that our political system is a proportional representation system, which very strongly is structurally built to favor political parties over independents. And without changing that up to make it more like our municipal system, you've kind of crudely bolted on this very janky system, the consequences of which could be quite unpleasant. Maurice, do you want to just take us a little bit through what this thing does and why it's not such a great idea?
Yeah, so as you say, the Constitutional Court said in 2020 that had to allow for independent candidates to stand. Easiest way of doing that would have been to kind of ramp up our municipal system, where people get two votes to vote for a political party, and then for somebody to represent them in their ward, which would be a constituency, obviously, if we're talking national level. And that person could be an independent or representative of a political party and so on. So what happens with that is people get somebody who represents them in a ward, but the makeup of the municipal council also reflects very closely the overall proportion of the vote that was cast. So that's the point of kind of a proportional representation system. But unfortunately, instead of rejigging the national, the system we use at national level and provincial level to, you know, kind of reflect what we do at municipal level. As you said, they just bolted on kind of independence on Agami kind of functioning as political parties, which, you know, it's kind of a logical absurdity. And at the same time, they've also, there are quite a few barriers that have been set up now for independence to run. They have to get, you know, a very large amount of signatures to even be put on the ballot, as do political parties that aren't registered with the IEC yet. So they've made it actually very hard for new political parties and for independents to run. There's also problems with the formula they're going to be using to work out seats that are awarded. You know, it could, it's going to definitely, depending on how many votes are cast for independents, we could actually see a situation where a political party wins fewer than 50% of the votes, but wins more than 50% of the seats in the legislature. So there's some significant problems with this legislation. It's definitely going to be challenged in court, but I don't see how we're going to get a resolution before the next election, which is can't be held later than August next year. And, you know, I think it would be very dangerous to even consider postponing it, which I don't think will happen. Constitutional Court has said before that they didn't allow the government to postpone the last municipal election because of COVID and so on. So I don't see that happening. So I think we're in for some interesting times ahead. Probably the only thing I'd say that is good in this legislation is that it does say that the minister must establish what's called an electoral reform consultation panel. So hopefully, and that must be set up for after the 2024 elections. So hopefully we'll get a much more, you know, much more logical and more easy to understand the electoral system after the 2024 elections. But as it stands, I mean, we're in this situation because, as usual, the government, you know, sat on its hands, waited until the last minute to sort this out, and we're sitting with now a very, you know, it's basically a logical system, but yeah, it's what we have now, and we're going to have to work with it for the 2024 elections.
Yeah, there's a bunch of stuff in this law which makes one a little bit uneasy. You know, when you start changing the rules of your electoral system, it's always something a little bit fraught, right? Because the integrity of an electoral system is really important for the legitimacy of the state. And I think it's worth remembering that when the parliamentary committee decided on what system to adopt to take forward the Constitutional Court's ruling, the minority view was the view that that has prevailed here, that has been placed into the Electoral Amendment Bill. The majority view, I believe, of that original committee was to do like our municipal systems with a constituency system. There are also some estimates that suggest that, in effect, the largest political party, I wonder who that could be, will benefit slightly from the current system, and in fact be able to get slightly more seats than they otherwise would have. So, I'm very concerned.
That'll benefit all the larger parties. So, you know, won't benefit just the largest party. It'll benefit the larger parties. So,
right. But still, not great. Mm. Particularly if the parliamentary result is hanging by only a few seats, those who can form a majority, then it's really going to be a big deal. I think any kind of change like that. Terence, what do you make of all this? It doesn't seem like a very happy situation we're in, but it also doesn't seem like one that's going to be easily resolved, because you've got these kind of, you know, the Constitutional Court making this demand on one hand, and then the government putting this not very good system, you know, in to try and fix the problem, and also, as Marius pointed out, a very short deadline as to fix things. What do you make of all this?
Well, the system we have now was instituted in 1994 as a stopgap measure, with the understanding that by the next election there would be some sort of revised electoral system, you know, with constituencies, or that was something that was kind of assumed in the early 90s, that we'd have some sort of constituency system, which would have to take into account the fact that certain parties are very widely spread, widely dispersed support. There were also some concerns about the kind of outcome that this would produce, because a lot of people kind of assume constituencies meant first past the post in each geographical area for one representative, as had been the case previously. But this sort of thing worked very well, and it pushed every incentive in our politics upwards, particularly for larger parties that needed the party discipline and the patronage. So by 1999, this was just a great system to have. I think there've been three official commissions of inquiry or three investigations that have recommended change. One of which was done by the late Friedrich von Zell Slobbert, which proposed a system along the lines of which Morris has discussed. And I understand, I can't remember where I read this, but as far as I know, it was never denied that when this was tabled in cabinet, Carter Asmal, who subsequently inveigled himself into becoming the great conscience of the nation, said this must be filed in a rubbish bin. The idea was that we just don't we're okay with this, nothing's going to change. So what we ended up with was something that could tinker around the edges. It was malicious compliance, essentially. How can we be in line with the letter of the demand without actually changing any of the substance, and crucially without changing the party dominance and the incentives that creates. I think that there is a sort of a pendulum that can go too far to the other side, saying that, well, electoral reform is a magic bullet. It's not, but it is a part of what could lead to something more productive. And that's why you have Musi Maimane's group, which went big on enabling independence, essentially having to draw up its own party list now, which I think is very much contrary to what they intended. I'm still, I actually wrote a piece about this about a year ago, and so I watch with interest to see how they manage it.
There's one of the ironies of this is that it's actually made it more logical than ever to really focus on building up a political, registering as a party, that kind of thing, because if you're going to run as an independent, it's got so many problems with it. All right. I think let's move on to our last story, unless, Maurice, you have anything to add?
Yeah, I'd just echo what Terence is saying. This isn't electoral reform is not a silver bullet, but we definitely need to think of ways to get people more involved. What do you see now? Voter turnout's dropping, and that's got some continued, fewer people vote, the fewer people would consider the government possibly legitimate. And I think that might have some serious questions for, or implications for, stability of South African democracy. So I think anything they can do to get more people involved and voting is very important.
Definitely.
I think we need creative solutions.
Yes, creative solutions. That's it. Good buzzword. Okay, so our last story for today is a statement put out by the Treasury Department of the United States talking about a network of sanctions evasion that they have discovered and that they are planning to crack down on. The U.S. Treasury has identified 52 individuals and entities in Lebanon, the UAE, Angola, the Ivory Coast, the DRC, Belgium, the United Kingdom, Hong Kong, and South Africa, who have been involved in aiding the organization Hezbollah, based in Lebanon, in evading sanctions. The Americans say the individuals involved in this network used shell companies and fraudulent schemes to disguise Nazir Saeed Ahmad's role in financial transactions. He's a senior figure in Hezbollah, with operations in Beirut, Dubai, Johannesburg, and Hong Kong. They direct a global network of family members, associates, and companies to take advantage of the permissive nature of the global diamond, precious gem, and art market to facilitate payment for and shipment and delivery of luxury goods. As a result of today's action, unless otherwise authorized, all property interests in property of these persons that are or come within the United States or in position or control of U.S. persons must be blocked and reported to the office, to the American government. In addition, any entities that are owned directly or indirectly 50% or more by one or more of the blocked persons are also blocked. What's interesting here is, I think, South Africa's role in it, and how we kind of seem to really be, and this explains, I think, our grey listing. In this, you see that we are part of a network that involves what I might call the other dodgy finance capitals of the world, places like Dubai, places like Hong Kong, but also that things like diamonds are flowing through the country. Maurice, what do you make of this story? I think that this is probably in some ways just the tip of the iceberg, that South Africa probably has a much larger integration into global sort of terror and clandestine financing networks. What do you think?
I don't think it should surprise us. We know that organizations like Hezbollah and Iranian terror groups have been involved in South Africa for many years. There were rumors that Pagad had links to those kind of organizations with the bombing of Cafe Hollywood, I think it was called, down in the Cape in the late 90s, I think. So this shouldn't surprise anybody. And also, I think South Africa as a finance hub is very well integrated into the rest of the world. So I think it's a place that's still pretty easy to get your money into and out of and move around and so on. And we have obviously quite a large Muslim community here. That obviously doesn't mean that all Muslims are going to be sympathetic to these kind of guys, but they probably will find some people who would be sympathizers and help them with this kind of thing. So yeah, it shouldn't surprise us, but it's also nice being on a list with Hong Kong and Dubai. So, you know, always look on the bright side, I think.
Hey, that's the spirit. In 30 seconds, Terence, your thoughts on the story?
Well, terror groups are enterprising and ingenious. And yes, you know, if we have the infrastructure, they will try to use it. I remember when after 9/11, I was in Taiwan, and I remember there was a report that they had identified 9 bank accounts in Taiwan, which is like the last place in the world you would expect, you know, Islamic Al Qaeda funding to be going through as being somehow, linked to that network.
All right, I think that is all the time we have for today. So thank you very much, everyone, for listening. We hope you found it interesting, and we will be back, of course, tomorrow on the Daily French Show. Cheers, everyone, and have a wonderful day.